Good morning to each of y'all. Yeah, I'd like to greet you in Christ's name. It's good to be here this morning. The sun's shining after a dreary day. It's invigorating to see sunshine. Wish my wife could be here. She's at home sick. So that makes it, I don't know why, but it makes it a little hard for me to preach up here. I'm used to seeing her beautiful face sitting in the audience, but I'll try and make do with her at home. And a number of y'all stated that y'all were praying for me. I just appreciate that. Appreciate that very much. Glad to have Mom and Karen back with us from, maybe they brought the Florida sunshine. And got some other visitors, and Franz's are back. It's good to see everybody. I don't really necessarily have a title for the message. I just titled it Lessons from 1 Chronicles 21. I read this chapter several mornings ago, and it just inspired me. There's not necessarily one point I want to bring out, but there's two things that David either did or stated in this chapter that I would like to notice. And it really blessed me. It really blessed me. 1 Chronicles chapter 21. David was in quite a fix in this chapter. He had some very tough decisions to make due to his own failures. If you would read the chapter before, you would find he had just come through a victorious time, and maybe he was feeling extra high and a little frisky. I don't know what his problem was, but he made a mistake in this chapter that he paid dearly for. They had just got done, like in this previous chapter, one of his nephews had killed a giant. Maybe, I don't know if killing giants ran in the family blood or what, but his nephew had killed a man with 12 fingers and 12 toes, and it seems like there was a bunch of other giants that might have fell in chapter 20. But they were having a It was a victorious time for Israel. And God seemingly has a way of, we talk about mountains and valleys. It seems like David was on a mountaintop. And I don't know how it is for y'all, but a lot of times after I'm on a mountaintop, it seems like I face a valley. I don't know why it is that way, but that's kind of what seems like happened here. So we'll read 1 Chronicles chapter 21. We'll read the start by reading the first six verses. 1 Chronicles 21:1. And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. And David said to Joab and to the rulers of the people, "Go, number Israel from Beersheba even to Dan, and bring the number of them to me that I may know it." And Joab answered, "The Lord make his people 100 times so many more as they be. But my lord the king, are they not all my lord's servants? Why then doth my lord require this thing? Why will he be a cause of the trespass to Israel?" Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Wherefore Joab departed and went throughout all Israel and came to Jerusalem. And Joab gave the sum of the number of the people unto David. And all they of Israel were 1,000, 1,000, and 100,000 men that drew sword. And Judah was 70,000 men that drew sword. But Levi and Benjamin counted he not among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab. So verse 1, we have Satan stirring up David, it says, provoking David. Remember last Sunday's message, Jason Miller talking about the devil stirring up grief in the church or in our lives? It's kind of what he was doing here. He was causing as much heartache as he could, and he tempted David to count the people. Why was that such a problem, and why was that such a sin for David to do this? I used to think, and it might be in Scripture, but I couldn't find it. I thought it was a commandment of God that the Israelites weren't to be counted. And it might be in there, and I missed it somewhere, but I couldn't actually find where it was forbidden. And like I say, I might have overlooked it. As a matter of fact, in Exodus 30, verses 11 through 16, you find God telling them to count the people, or at least some of the people. But there was a difference there. It needed to be done to raise money for the building of the tabernacle. And everybody that was counted in that instance was supposed to give a half a shekel of gold for the building of the temple or the tabernacle that they were working on. In verse 15, I found this a little interesting, just a side note. The rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less. And that was at the time when they were giving that their half shekel. And I think God wanted everybody to realize in that little statement that everybody is worth the same to him. No matter what their financial status is, everybody is worth the same. We all cost the same to God. In fact, God called it at that time a ransom for their soul. But this time, I think David's mess up was he was trying to compare himself with his neighbors. He wanted to see, how are we doing on our population versus theirs? Are we bigger than them? Are we stronger than them? Are we growing faster? He was doing it for all the wrong reasons. God wanted the Israelites to have a faith in him that he alone can deliver them from whatever's facing them. He didn't want them to rely on their numbers. And I think that's where David messed up. And I don't know why David should have known that all those old stories. I mean, Gideon and the 300 men, he should have known some of this stuff. But David was human, just like me and you are. Verse 3, we have Joab trying his best not to do this. He did not like this idea. He knew why David was doing it, and he knew that God was going to be displeased with it. And he tried to talk David out of it, but David wouldn't hear of it. And in verse 4, Joab, it says, the word prevailed not, and Joab went out. I have a question. Do you think, was this a sin for Joab to go count the people? Did Joab sin by counting the people? He reluctantly obeyed orders. I don't know if it was a sin for him to do it or not. It's a question I have. He was commanded to do it, and so he followed orders, but he did it very reluctantly. But he knew it was wrong, so I don't know. I guess you can tell me after church if you think it was a sin or not. Anyway, he comes back with a number, 1,570,000 men that drew sword. And the fact that he counted the sword bearers tells me that David won a number of the fighting men to compare himself to other nations around him. He wasn't, I don't think he counted the women and the children. He wanted a number of who all can fight. And another interesting thing, in 2 Samuel, you have this account also, 2 Samuel 24, and it gives a different number of the men that were counted. It was 300,000 less in that number, and some people want to point to that as one of the things that the Bible's not accurate, or the Bible doesn't make. This is one of the things they point to sometime. And I just want to point out, in 2 Samuel, it says they counted the valiant men, and that would have been the men with battle experience. Here they counted all the men that drew the sword. So that's not necessarily a place where we can point at Scripture and say it's not accurate. Another thing, Joab skipped the counting of the tribes of Levi and Benjamin. It seems like he just couldn't stomach this counting anymore. Maybe he was out running around, it says in 2 Samuel, for 9.5 months counting these people. He might have been sick and tired of walking all and down all these hills. Israel isn't necessarily like Kansas. I mean, running around all them hills was probably, I don't know if he decided to take a shortcut and skip these two tribes. I don't know what was going on, but I think he was probably doing it to save Israel some grief. He just didn't want to get the complete number for whatever reason. All right, we'll read verses 7 now. 7 through 17. And God was displeased with this thing, and therefore he smote Israel. And David said unto God, I have sinned greatly because I have done this thing. But now I beseech thee, do away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. And the Lord spake to Gad, David's seer, saying, Go and tell David, saying, Thus saith the Lord, I offer thee three things. Choose thee one of them, that I may do it unto thee. So Gad came to David and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord, choose thee either 3 years famine, or 3 months to be destroyed before thy foes, while that the sword of thine enemies overtake thee, or else 3 days of the sword of the Lord, even the pestilence in the land, and the angel of the Lord destroying throughout all the coasts of Israel. Now therefore advise thyself what word I shall bring again to him that sent me. And David said unto Gad, I am in great strait. Let me fall now into the hand of the Lord, for very great are his mercies, but let me not fall into the hand of men. So the Lord sent pestilence upon Israel, and there fell of Israel 70,000 men. And God sent an angel unto Jerusalem to destroy it. And as he was destroying, the Lord beheld, and he repented him of the evil, and said to the angel that destroyed, It is enough, stay now thine hand. And the angel of the Lord stood by the threshing floor of Oren the Jebusite. And David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord stand between heaven and earth, having a drawn sword in his hand, stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders of Israel, who were clothed in sackcloth, fell on their faces. And David said unto God, Is it not I that commanded the people to be numbered? Even I it is that have sinned and done evil indeed. But as for these sheep, what have they done? Let thy hand, I pray thee, O Lord my God, be upon me and my father's house, but not on my people, that they should be plagued. So it didn't take long for God long to cause David to see the error of his ways. It says he smote Israel. Y'all remember when Charles Hamilton was here? And one phrase he said that forevermore stuck in my mind, ideas have consequences. David's idea had some serious consequences here, and he had to reap what he sowed. So the Lord sent word through Gad, David's seer, David's prophet, and he had three hard decisions to make. 3 years of watching his beloved nation starve, a famine, 3 months of being chased around by his enemies, or 3 days of the sword of the Lord. I can imagine a lot of David's enemies, if they would have gotten news of this option number two, they'd have been jumping up and down for the chance. They'd have probably loved to chase David all over the hills for 3 months. Verse 13 is one of the verses that blessed me as I read this. David's response, he says he's in great strait, deep distress. And his response is such a blessing. He knew the mercy of his God. And he made a very wise choice in choosing that option. And we'll read about that later. But he says, Let me fall into the hand of the Lord, for very great are his mercies. Isn't it a blessing to know that God in his wrath towards us as men at times is still a safer place than being in the hatred of men? You're still safer in God's wrath than being in the hatred of men. Man can be filled with a consuming hatred that has no end and will destroy to the very end. But God is a loving God, and even in his wrath, he has a heart of love and compassion for his children. I can't emphasize that enough. That's a blessing to me that we serve a God like that. It should fill me with a deep gratitude, and it should fill you with a deep gratitude also. And David obviously knew this about God. He knew this about God, and I think it helped him in his decision. He knew about it because for many years he had a deep relationship with God. He couldn't bear the thought of watching his earthly enemies chase him around, and he couldn't bear the thought of watching his people starve, but somehow he could bear the thought of being in God's, even if it was in God's wrath, he'd have rather been there than anywhere else. It doesn't mean that it made the punishment easier. It doesn't mean it made it easy to bear and fun or anything like that. It was a hard place to be, but it was still where he wanted to be. And then he gets to see the horror of his decisions come to pass. We read about that. And can you imagine watching 70,000 people of your nation die? I don't know what the population of Jonesboro is, but I think it's something around that number. A whole town of Jonesboro dying because of one decision you made? I don't know if y'all remember, you might not, but I preached a message a while back about how disobedience does not just affect you, it affects everybody around you. This was exactly what happened here. It affected what David made this mistake, and he might have had some of the support of the elders of Israel. I don't know. It seems like he would have. But that decision that he made, along with whoever else, affected the whole nation. In verse 15, we see David was exactly right about banking on the mercies of the Lord. It seems the angel was headed to Jerusalem with his sword stretched out. And God stopped him. It is enough, stay now thy hand. So David and the elders fell down on their faces. And they took complete responsibility for their actions. And he had a very valid point. He said, God, why do these people, the sheep, have to suffer and not me? Why? I don't know exactly, but I wonder if it wasn't probably more of a punishment for David to watch this happen than if he would have actually died. I don't know, just a thought. All right, let's read verses 18 through 30, the rest of the chapter here. Then the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and set up an altar unto the Lord in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And David went up at the saying of Gad, which he spoke in the name of the Lord. And Ornan turned back and saw the angel and his four sons with him, and they hid themselves. Now Ornan was threshing wheat. And as David came to Ornan, Ornan looked and saw David and went out of the threshing floor and bowed himself to David with his face to the ground. And David said to Ornan, grant me the place of this threshing floor, that I may build an altar therein unto the Lord. Thou shalt grant it me for the full price, that the plague may be stayed from the people. And Ornan said unto David, take it to thee, and let my lord the king do that which is good in his eyes. Lo, I give thee the oxen also for burnt offerings, and the threshing instruments for the wood, and the wood for the meat offerings, I give it all. And the king David said to Ornan, nay, but I will verily buy it for the full price, for I will not take that which is thine for the Lord, nor offer burnt offerings without cost. So David gave Ornan for the place 600 shekels of gold by weight. And David built there an altar unto the Lord, and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings, and called upon the Lord. And he answered him from heaven by fire upon the altar of the burnt offering. And the Lord commanded the angel, and he put up his sword again into the sheath thereof. At that time when David saw the Lord, he had answered him in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, and then he sacrificed there. For the tabernacle of the Lord, which Moses made in the wilderness, and the altar of the burnt offerings were at that season in the high place of Gibeon. But David could not go before it to inquire of the Lord, for he was afraid because of the sword of the angel of the Lord. So, there in verse 18, 19, David was in the listening mood again. He was ready to listen to what God had to say. And so Gad had told David to go through the threshing floor of Ornan. And verse 20, we have Ornan doing kind of an odd thing for a time of trouble like this. He was out working, him and his four sons. You'd have thought with all the drama going on, I don't know, I'd have went and hid in the storm shelter or in the basement, or I'd have went somewhere, but maybe he wasn't so different from me today. Sometimes the easiest thing to get your mind off of everything around you is just to go do something normal, like go to work. And so maybe that's what he was doing. Maybe he just wanted something normal and predictable in this frightening time of his life. But he was out here working, him and his four sons, and they got the fright of their life. Can you imagine seeing an angel in the sky with its sword drawn? That would be an experience you probably wouldn't forget. And he went and hid himself. Can you blame him? Him and his four sons went and hid him, and that's where David found him. And David pretty much told him, "I'm here to buy this threshing floor from you." Verse 22, "I want this threshing floor, and I'm going to buy it from you, and I'm going to build an altar for the Lord to try to get this plague off the land." And it seems like it was going to be a pretty easy deal to make. Ornan was a very willing seller at this point. And he said, "Guess what, David? It's your lucky day. I'm going to give you a deal on it. You're going to like this, David." And this is a point that I really appreciate, the second point I really appreciated in this chapter. Ornan said, "I'm going to give you the whole piece of property. You can have the title, you're welcome to it, it's yours. And guess what else? I'm going to just throw in the oxen for the burnt offering. You don't even have to go get them. Oh, and here's the tools I was using to beat out the wheat. You can have the tools. Oh, and go ahead and take the wheat, too, for the offering. Tell you what, just take everything. I'll just walk off. You can have everything. It's free. Take it. Give it to the Lord. Whatever you want to do with it, it's yours." And David's response is something that it's something I can learn from today. It seems like today, and man, it's been like this a long time. It's not just today, but it seems like maybe we notice it more today. Did you ever notice everybody wants something for nothing? There's something attractive about something for nothing. I'm in my job. I get out about quite a bit, and I stand in lines sometimes at gas station. And you know what I see? I see people trying to get something for nothing. They're buying those paper lottery tickets, and it just about drives me nuts. I've seen people walk up, and they'll give a $20 bill to the cashier, and they'll take the other paper, and they'll scan it, and they'll throw it in the trash. And it astounds me. It's like, why wouldn't you just throw your $20 bills in the trash and watch a mad scramble for people pawing through the trash can? You would at least have entertainment value. But it's the thrill of something for nothing. It's the hope of getting a big thing for almost nothing that is almost irresistible. CNBC reported that you have a one chance in 302,575,350 of winning a Mega Millions lottery ticket. That was several years ago. I don't know if that's still true, or I don't know how they did their math, but that's what the news, that's what they reported. They said right underneath that you have a 1 in 2.7 million chance of being attacked by a grizzly bear in a state park. So you have a whole lot more chance of getting attacked by a grizzly bear than you would of winning the lottery. But the people are lining up for it. They say average American spends over $1,000 a year on lottery tickets. And I know we don't have a problem here buying lottery tickets. I've never bought one, and I don't ever plan to. But they say it's the second fastest growing addiction in North America today. So that we have a culture of people that are grabbing to get something for nothing. And you know what? I actually get that temptation. it's exciting, the thought of getting something that you didn't have to pay anything for. Y'all probably heard of there's a multimillionaire man by the name of Forrest Fenn. Y'all might have read his story. But he was an antique dealer for his whole life. And in 2010, he got the bright idea that he's going to take $1 million worth of gold and he's going to put it in a treasure box and he's going to bury it in the Rocky Mountains. And then he's going to write a poem about how to find this and just watch what happens. And it's estimated that 350,000 people looked for it. Some of them even died looking for it. Now, I don't know how they estimated their 350,000 people that were looking for it. They might have counted me sitting on the easy chair reading the poem, thinking it's a good idea to go look for it, and then figuring out, I could never figure this out. I don't know. I don't know if they counted people like that or not. But 350,000 people looking for this thing. And here just a couple of years ago, it was found by a man by the name of Jack Stoff, 32-year-old man from, I don't even know what state he was from. But the thought of something for nothing drove people all over the Rocky Mountains with this man's poem trying to find it. It was almost irresistible. I think we humans tend towards more lazy than not. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing to get something as a gift. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to get something for free. But I am saying living your life with the attitude of constantly trying to attain something for nothing is wrong. And at its core, it's actually a very selfish thought. Sadly, I can see that in me sometimes. I want to make for absolutely sure all my own needs are met before I'm willing to give to others. Or maybe there is always that one more tool to buy. Have you men ever noticed that? There's always one more tool to buy or one more truck to upgrade. There's always something that we think is going to make us just around the bend. If we get that one thing, we're going to be happy. But look at David's, back to this story, verse 24. And King David said to Ornan, "Nay, but I will verily buy it for a full price. I will not take that which is thine for the Lord, nor offer burnt offering without cost." David wasn't falling for this something for nothing for one instance. He was not taking something to pay a debt to God that he owed that didn't cost him anything. He wasn't going to do it. He was king, and probably paying for this property didn't dent his wallet one bit. It probably didn't affect him that much. But he was not going to take it for free. And we notice Abraham did the same thing when he was looking for a burial plot to bury his wife. The king wanted to give him land, but Abraham wouldn't take it. So verse 22, we have David buying this land. Oop, I backed up too far. No, I turned the wrong page. That's what happened. So David bought this property, and unless I missed my guess, he probably paid a very fair price for it. I don't know what property values were back then, so it's no way to tell if what he paid for it was a fair sum back then, but probably he was very generous with his offer. And he built his offer, and he sacrificed. And can you imagine the relief and glory be when fire fell from heaven? And he knew that God accepted his offering. And just as a side note, this is the exact spot where Solomon built the temple several years later. You can find that in 2 Chronicles 3:1. This offering David made was to be made in Gibeon. It says some about that at the very end of this chapter. It's where the offerings were being sacrificed at that time. But it seems David was afraid to go there because he was scared in the trip there, the Lord's wrath would be rekindled again when he wasn't around and he would strike Jerusalem. So David just stayed right there, and it seems like this is where he made the rest of his offerings for the rest of his life. He had a very, he was very attracted to this piece of property. And can you blame him? He had a very close encounter with God at that spot. So there's two things I want you to remember out of this message. David might have failed miserably in this time in his life, but he did get two things right. God's mercy, even in his wrath, is far safer than we could ever hope to get from man. Lamentations 3, 22 and 23 says, "It is of the Lord's mercy that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness." That's our God. That was David's God, and he knew it. And the second point is, David didn't fall for something for nothing. He was living with the attitude of a giver and not a taker. And human nature wants to make us feel like when we're losing by giving, but we're not. And David knew that. He was not losing by paying for this. In closing, I'll read Psalms 30. I'll just read it. I'm not going to make a whole lot of comments. This was, or is thought to be, a psalm that David wrote as he was going through this time in life. It probably wasn't exactly right after this account in Chronicles, but it was around that time. And if you just listen to the words as I read it, you can understand. It made sense to me when I read it. So we'll read verse 30, and then we'll close. Chapter 30, and then we'll close. David's saying, "I will extol thee, O my Lord, for thou hast lifted me up and hast not made my foes to rejoice over me. O Lord my God, I cried unto thee, and thou hast healed me. O Lord, thou hast brought up my soul from the grave. Thou hast kept me alive, that I should not go down to the pit. Sing unto the Lord, O ye his saints, O saints of his, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness. For his anger endureth but a moment, and his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. And in my prosperity I said, I shall never be moved. Lord, be thou favor, thou hast made my mountain to stand strong. Thou didst hide thy face, and I was troubled. I cried to thee, O Lord, and unto the Lord I made supplication. What profit is there in my blood when I go down to the pit? Shall the dust praise thee? Shall it declare thy truth? Hear, O Lord, and have mercy upon me. Lord, be thou my helper. Thou hast turned for me my mourning into dancing. Thou hast put off my sackcloth and girded me with gladness, to the end that my glory may sing praise to thee and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give thanks unto thee forever." Why don't we kneel for prayer?